I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Ben Barnes knows politics from the inside. He was elected to the Texas legislature at age 22, became Speaker of the Texas House at 26, and Lieutenant Governor at 30. In his new book, Barn Burning, Barn Building, Ben provides a window on what really happens in the halls of power, and he is our guest today on Smart City. Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer has also seen politics at the highest levels, having worked at the White House. And now as founder and president of America Speaks, she is developing new democratic practices to strengthen citizens' voices in public decision-making, and we'll find out about her work today. Also with us is Larry Keeley, who Businessweek calls one of the world's leading innovators. As head of Doblin, Larry is leading a first-ever series of innovation workshops for urban leaders organized by CEOs for cities. That's today on Smart City, right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Ben Barnes has been an influential player on the American political scene for four decades. His new book, Barn Burning, Barn Building, chronicles his remarkable insider travels through the halls of power. Ben, you ran for the Texas legislature at age 21. You were elected at age 22. You became the Speaker of the Texas House at 26, Lieutenant Governor at 30. What allowed you to achieve so much political success at such a young age, and what can other young people learn from your experience?
Well, first of all, Carol, I must say that I was probably the luckiest young man in Texas political history to be able to do that at such a young age. But I would tell young people that they have to work harder, and they have to be better prepared. They have to do their homework. But I believe firmly that if young people, no matter what their age may be, if they're willing to do the sacrifice of to make the sacrifice to go be the most prepared person in the room. I was asked this question the other night: what could I do as a young person? This person wanted to run for office, and it was before a crowd of about 1,000 people. And I answered the question this way: if you're young, the only one thing that you can do to make up for the lack of experience you have, and that is to be the most qualified person in the room on the subjects that's being discussed. You've got to do your homework like it's a college course or a high school course. You've got to be better prepared. You've got to make an A when it comes to content. And if you do that, I find that the American people really want to help young people, and they really want young people to have a greater voice. But they've had experience with their own children, their grandchildren, and you know, as so many people said to me, well, Ben, you come back in 10 years, and I really want to vote for you and help you, but you've not had any experience. You're only 21 years old. And the only way to make up for that is to be better prepared and more qualified on that particular subject that's being discussed that day.
You tell a colorful story in your book where you disagreed quite vocally with John Connolly about his prospects for winning the gubernatorial runoff. On the morning of the runoff, you told him, apparently on a speakerphone, that the race would be much closer than he or any of his advisors imagined, and he proceeded to call you crazy and a stupid SOB.
That's right.
And that followed at least one incident when you told him, when he was considering running for governor and thought he would have little competition, that the positive things being said were about the dumbest things you had ever heard. How old were you then?
Well, I was 23 when I first met John Connolly, and I guess I was 24 that day when I told him that he was going to barely win the Democratic runoff. I guess that that's one instance where being maybe a little comeuppance and not having enough sense to remain quiet paid off, because I was so fortunate. I'd been up, Carol, for about 7 days without very little sleep campaigning for Governor Connolly, and that particular Friday night I'd gotten in bed about 3:30 or 4, and I got a call from Governor Connolly, and he did put me on the speakerphone, and he'd had all of his political cohorts and campaign workers and strategists all in a room, and they'd been telling him these glory stories about how he was going to sweep Texas and be elected governor, but somewhere between 250 and 500,000 votes, and I guess maybe I was tired and I didn't like to be awakened after only 3 hours sleep, and he said, well, what do you think? It looks like really good. And I said, well, no, it doesn't look good, Mr. Secretary. I called him Mr. Secretary because he'd been Secretary of the Navy. I said, Mr. Secretary, it really doesn't look good at all. You're going to win, but I tell you, it's going to be very close. You're going to lose a lot of the counties that you think you're going to carry, and I think you're going to win by around 25,000 votes. And with that, he did go into this tirade that I didn't know what I was talking about. And he did it in front of all these other people. So I was so tired, I just hung up on the next governor of Texas that morning. And we didn't talk again till that night. And he called me in a very meek and very wonderfully warm voice. And Ben, I must tell you that looks like we've got this thing won about 25,000 votes. And you're one smart SOB. And I look forward to listening to you a lot more. But that was another piece of luck. But it was a very funny experience.
Do politicians today hear enough truth from the people around them?
No, they don't. And that's one of the things that I say in Barn Burning, Barn Building, this book, is that I think the number one problem today facing America is not the big national deficit, not the 140,000 plus men and women that are in Iraq, not the energy crisis and the fact that we're so dependent on Middle East oil. I think the number one problem in America today is the fact that this country has become so bitterly divided with partisan politics. And I think it's become a campaign era where political consultants, they don't focus on telling the candidates what they should say. They focus on telling the candidates what kind of spots and on radio and television they should develop to go not only beat their opponents but destroy their opponents. And the politics of destruction are not very healthy. And many of our people that are running for office are not being told the truth.
They're not very constructive. They're probably not good for the country, but they work. And that's the problem. You know it. How do we make those tactics not work?
Well, you know, that's going to take it's going to probably be an evolution rather than a revolution, because people like negative politics when they're pointing out something that's wrong with someone. We've become accustomed to this, and it's so unhealthy. But I think it's going to take some leaders that are going to be willing to stand up and tell the people the truth and not to grasp single issue politics. One of the problems with both parties is that they are plan their campaigns to cultivate single issue groups, whether it's anti-abortion or for abortion, whether it's prayer in schools or not praying in school, whether it's gay marriage or not, or being against gay marriage, you know, whether it's stem cell research or being against stem cell research. Instead of talking about developing an economic policy that's going to retire the deficit, instead of developing a foreign policy that's going to bring a lot of the countries together, NATO and the United Nations, and try to work on all these problems globally, because we do live in a global world, it's not so important how you stand on these major issues. It's how you stand on these issues that negative campaign spots can be developed. And I think it's way, way past time for the American people to start really analyzing what's going to be good, not only for them and their particular wishes and desires, but what's going to be good for the next generation, for their children and their grandchildren.
Well, I hope someone will develop that message. Ben, you plan John Kennedy's trip to Dallas, November 22nd, 1963. What do you remember about that day?
Well, I remember about the time leading up to that day as being I really didn't realize what an important thing that I was involved in. I certainly didn't realize how that trip to Texas was going to end in such a tragedy. But President Kennedy came to Texas to raise money. He had not been able to raise money in Texas in 1960 in the campaign because all the money had to stay in Texas, because Texas was such a key state, and that's a reason, quite frankly, I think that Vice President Johnson was asked to be on the ticket, because Texas was so vital. But Kennedy wanted to come. 1964 was coming very rapidly, and he needed money for the campaign, so they were coming to Texas. And we had a very busy schedule. On the ferry, fatal day in November, when President Kennedy was assassinated, he spoke at a breakfast in Fort Worth that morning, and then had a public speech in the parking lot at the Worth Hotel in Fort Worth, then went to Dallas. There was a luncheon plan, and then on to Austin for a parade and a large gala that night with two receptions before the time. And one of the reasons we were opposed to having a parade in Dallas was the fact that Nellie Connelly, the First Lady of Texas then, said, you know, we're bringing the First Lady of the United States here, and I think all the ladies in the audience will identify with this. We're bringing the First Lady of the United States here, and we're going to give her 30 minutes after she's been campaigning all day and traveling throughout the state. She's going to have 30 minutes to put on a formal gown and get to the governor's mansion, and that's just totally too much burden to put on her to have so little time. And so I found out in the Connolly family very quickly that it was better to listen to Nellie Connolly than to John Connolly. And so I was trying to represent Nellie Connolly. But Vice President Johnson and Governor Connolly, neither one wanted a parade in Texas, in Dallas. They didn't think anything as tragic was going to happen. But Dallas had been a real, real hotbed of very, very right-wing people that had embarrassed Adlai Stevenson when he came there in 1956. They'd hit him in the face with campaign placards. And then in 1960, when President Johnson and Ms. Lady Bird Johnson walked across the street from one hotel to another, some people in the crowd actually spat on them. And that was just not something that we didn't want to happen in Dallas. But anyway, we had another United States Senator, Senator Yarber, who said it was not fair for Kennedy to come to Dallas and to raise money and not for the people to see him. And he insisted on a parade. We said no. We said no one time. We said no two times. The third time, Senator Yarber talked to the then brother of Jack Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, and persuaded him they should have the parade. And we finally acquiesced after then Vice President Johnson called and said we should do what the Kennedy family wanted. And I've thought many times about how history might have been changed if we had just put our foot down and said, no, we're not going to have that parade. Lee Harvey Oswald might not have had that target in Dallas, and history might have been completely changed.
You were with Bill Moyers when you heard the news. You were in Austin planning for the dinner that night. And there was one small detail in your chapter, Ben, about that day that struck me, and that was that the ticket for the fundraiser that night was $100. And you were going to serve them a steak dinner, and you'd had to push a lot of people into buying that $100 ticket for John Kennedy. You are today a successful lobbyist, a major political fundraiser. Is there too much money in the system?
There's absolutely too much money in the system, and I think it's that we're going to have to make some major changes. Money means so much in politics today, and it comes from so many different sources. And people, by and large, business leaders throughout the country give money, labor leaders give money, but it's people that have an interest in what's going to happen on a lot of specific legislation. And yes, we need campaign finance reforms. We particularly need them at the state level. Tom DeLay came to Texas and put in 2 years ago to get the redistricting bill passed in Texas, there were 16 state representative races. Now that we have 150 House members in Texas, and there were 16 of them that were in marginal districts. They could go either way. And Tom DeLay brought between $300,000 and $350,000 to each one of those races the last 60 days. And with that money, 15 of those 16 races went to the Republican Party because of that much money. And there's examples of where the Democratic Party has done the same thing. I'm not picking out that as just an example. But when you have that much money, when I ran for state representative, and, you know, a lot of people said, well, that was just right after the Civil War. That was so long ago, Ben. But I spent about $2,800 in my three-county area. A person running for state representative in that part of Texas 2 years ago spent almost $1 million. Now, there's been inflation and dollars values have changed, but $2,800 to $1 million in 40 years, that's unbelievable. And so money does, it's not wrong to contribute. I want to encourage people to keep contributing to politics, but we have to come up with some type of reasonable guidelines and some caps because money has too much influence in politics.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Ben Barnes. He's the author of a terrific new book, Barn Burning, Barn Building, Tales of a Political Life from LBJ to George W. Bush and beyond. I was struck by your characterization of why you were in 1963 attracted to the candidacy of John Connolly. We talked about him earlier, but he understood Texas, the oil business, the cattle business, but, and I'm quoting from your book, in Washington, he got his eyes opened as to what was happening in terms of what states were doing to prepare for the future. He saw firsthand where all the grants were going, or technology study and development. He saw where the world was moving, and Texas was not in that forefront. He saw that investment followed education. He really got the baptism. And you shared that vision. How did your collective understanding transform Texas?
Well, we increased the appropriations from 1963 to 1973 for higher education 1,800% in that 10-year period. That's the largest increase any state has ever had over a decade, over a 10-year period. And we really were able to put the University of Texas and Texas A&M and our other colleges and university in a position to be competitive with the schools in Massachusetts, with the schools in North Carolina, with the schools in California and in Michigan and Illinois. We made our state competitive. We raised faculty salaries. We started research. Research was the industry, the information age, the transformation that the South and Texas underwent from being a land of cattle and cotton and agriculture and oil and gas to the information age. Those industries followed where the research dollars were being spent at colleges and universities. And that's why we must continue this in all over the United States, but particularly in the South and Southwest. Well, I think the fact that Austin became the Silicon Valley of Texas, and the fact that we've had so many high-tech information companies be located in Dallas and Houston and Austin is because of the money that we invested in higher education. We brought the brains here. We produced the graduates. You know, there's a telling story, and I just got back from India. This year in the United States, we're going to produce about 38,000 engineers that are going to graduate from colleges and universities. 38,000. In India alone this year, they're going to graduate 380,000 engineers, 10 times the number of engineers that we're graduating. And we're going to find that China and India both are outpacing the United States as far as education and looking to the future and looking what the people need to be trained in to be able to be a part of the technological age that's going to happen in the future. And I'm very concerned the fact that we may not be the number one leader in development of jobs and new industry and new high-tech industry particularly. There could be a chart published 10 years from now that's going to say, well, the United States is doing a little better, but they're still third. China's number one, and India's number two, and the United States is number three. And this, we cannot let this happen. And this is why other states, and Texas too, must follow the example that we were fortunate enough to set back in the 60s when we invested so much more money in research and development and in higher education and in bringing brain power to our states.
You were a friend and colleague of Lyndon Johnson. You saw the country fray during his presidency over the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Act. Ben, do you see signs that we may be headed there again?
Yes, unfortunately, Carol, I do. I did live through the period of Vietnam, and I saw in the young people's eyes when I spoke on college campuses and universities, and I saw their mistrust and their outright anger, and then of course their anger was later taken to the streets in the mass protest against Vietnam. I think that it's so important that if we are going to send young men and women to foreign soil to fight with their lives for this country, that we must be absolutely candid with the American people. We need to tell them exactly why they're there, and when we are going to be able to bring them home, and why we are specifically there fighting and risking their lives. I think President Johnson, I'll defend him a little bit, he inherited the war, but he too became seduced by the generals that were telling him, yes, Mr. President, we can win this war. Give us more troops. Let's drop more bombs. We just got to be more aggressive. And we saw what happened, that it was a very embarrassing retreat that we came from Vietnam. I think Iraq is another Vietnam from this standpoint. We have not been told the truth about why we went to Iraq. We were told that there were weapons of mass destruction there, and they were not. And I just think if our president and this administration would go on television before the American people and say, look, we're wrong, we're sorry, but we made a mistake. I think one of the things that's lacking in this country today is people being in elected public office, being willing to admit they've made mistakes. And people will understand and they'll forgive, but they will not forgive you not telling them the truth. And I think that's where we find America today, and I think that's why we find the president's poll numbers under 30%, one of the lowest that's ever happened in the history of this country. You got to tell people the absolute truth why you're doing something. The American people are very smart. And they'll normally make the right decision, and they'll support our president as commander-in-chief if you tell them the truth.
You write also in your book about the Civil Rights Act and the fact that Lyndon Johnson, you certainly knew Lyndon Johnson would be very unpopular for what he had done, particularly in Texas, particularly in the South. And you began to see that in the very few states that Barry Goldwater won in his race. And you said that Martin King and Ralph Abernathy kept pushing Johnson to pass more legislation, that would be the solution, to pass more legislation. I'm curious again, do you see any parallels, Ben, with the social agenda today in America? Is it moving too fast? Is it moving at the right pace? What's your response to that?
Well, I think this, that the civil rights legislation of the 60s and voting rights, that's all been law now. I think that probably where we're making a mistake is we've got to recognize that our minority population in this country is growing very, very rapidly, and we're going to end up in another 10 years. In Texas, it's going to happen a lot quicker in 10 years, where the minority Americans are going to have control of the voting booth. Where we're making a mistake is we're not taking all the steps that are needed to educate all of our citizens. Our young people, black Americans, brown Americans, yellow Americans, particularly brown and black Americans, we have the highest high school dropout in the United States. The highest public school dropout in the United States is here in Texas. And what's happening is we're sending 4 out of every 10 black young males to the penitentiary. Well, it costs about $3,000 to $4,000 for a pre-kindergarten program. It costs about $40,000 to incarcerate that person in one of our state's penal institutions. It makes so much more sense for us to go get these young people when they're young, before they're even starting to school, and to teach them English and to give them fundamental ingredients that will help them be prepared to be a first grader, a second grader, and give them, if necessary, if people are going to bed hungry, hungry people can't learn at the same rate that people that are not hungry. We have to have the head start. We have to have programs that are going to provide some type of quality of life for these young people where they can become productive citizens. The greatest way to solve the social ills of America today is to educate Americans and not have people that have dropped through the cracks. The fewer people that we have dropping through the cracks, then the brighter and better the future is going to be for all of us in America.
Ben, you've written a terrific book, Barn Burning, Barn Building, Tales of a Political Life from LBJ to George W. Bush and Beyond. Ben Barnes, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you. It's great to be on Smart City, and thank you for the job you're doing for your listeners.
Ben Barnes' new book is Barn Burning, Barn Building, published by Bright Sky Press. Larry Keeley has been called one of the world's leading innovators by Business Week. In 2 weeks, Larry begins a first-time-ever series of innovation workshops for urban leaders sponsored by CEOs for Cities, and he talks about innovation today with us. Larry, your analysis shows that governments are notoriously low-producing innovators. Why?
I can speculate about the structural causes. And I think they have to do with the fact that, by and large, governments, being born so much of political people, too often don't want to take pioneering risks and too often have to optimize things in the short run because that's, you know, when re-elections occur. So it's hard to get people to do something over a longer time horizon when, in fact, you know, they can't see themselves getting a payback in the time that voters will notice and care about. Depressing to have to say that that's one of the structural causes, but it almost certainly is.
Well, if they're willing to engage in pioneering risks and not focus exclusively on optimizing in the short term, what would be the payoff?
Well, it would depend on context and the boldness of the case. What I think you see, for instance, here in Chicago in Millennium Park is a huge payoff in terms of global visibility and brand. You see something similar with the Bilbao Guggenheim. You know, sometimes when people take really bold risks, they look stupid on paper. So the payback normally for being bold is enormous in innovation because, curiously, the things that are sensible, safe, and predictable and give you a provable financial return on investment, in fact, are not safe at all because nobody notices. Whereas the ones that are, in fact, pretty gutsy often will radically alter people's sense of possibilities, and they'll be quite thrilling. But here again, this is a simple thing where, since most people don't know innovation fundamentals at all, they don't know which level of boldness to pursue and how to be kind of gutsy and how to de-risk the gutsy moves. Another issue that I think we have to face up to is that, by and large, in many governments, you get people who are paid a lot less than they're paid in industry. And so you end up with, you know, people very uncomfortable taking risks that go well beyond their budget authority or their pay grade or anything else.
Let me ask you something, though, Larry. The two examples you gave, the Guggenheim in Bilbao and Millennium Park in Chicago, are both capital projects. I'm sure you're not limiting boldness and innovation to capital projects.
Of course not. Singapore and even for the moment, California, where both are making huge commitments to bio-research sector and trying to become centers of excellence for that sort of thing. And essentially, they're passing laws and they're creating, or at least trying to get business to provide facilities that they can allow people to use at low cost, or creating incubation kinds of capabilities. And they're essentially streamlining procedures for people to start new businesses, stuff like that.
Can innovation become routine and repeatable? It's hard to think about having even the bandwidth to repeat a Millennium Park in any sort of political time frame. How do you respond to that?
Well, first off, I devoted my life to making sure that innovation wasn't a rare episodic event that only happened when lightning strikes. So I fervently believe that you can teach innovation excellence to people and have them master it, and then they can get it to happen at the pace that they choose and with the cadence that they determine is strategically appropriate. So the way I explain this to clients is I say, look, think about it as what one of my colleagues calls escalator delivery. You know how long the escalator is going to take. You decide how frequently you want to stick something at the bottom of the escalator headed towards the top, and you know when it's going to come off the top. Just pick the level of activity that you think is strategically right. What I would say is that some communities need a very aggressive innovation cadence because they're behind the eight ball. They're not distinctive. People don't know about them. Maybe there's a flight out of the city. Maybe there's not enough development in the city. Those are places that probably need to innovate or they're going to be facing long-term decline. Other cities, and, you know, sadly I'd have to include Chicago, have no innovation plan but are distinctive enough in and of themselves that, you know, pretty much nobody notices because it's a cool place.
So then for urban leaders to be ready to innovate, what do they need to do?
Well, the most important thing is that they have to get their senior executives to gather together and to determine what their innovation intent is. So that means looking at diagnostics, trying to get a sense of how much innovation, how fast is important to us, getting a sense of the mission for innovation so that it's not random and brainstorming. You know, if there's only one big thing we could achieve with innovation, what should it be? So if you want to be strategic with innovation, you want to get it to succeed and not be wasteful, the thing you do is you concentrate your firepower around some kind of mission.
And if you could tackle any urban innovation, what would it be?
You know, I think that there's a lot to be said for innovation around big topics that are going to be huge in the coming time period, like sustainability. I think there's something to be said for innovating around sort of safe, secure support for young people. You want to stop global terrorism, make sure that every child has a wonderful life. So, and the other corresponding part of that is innovation around safe, secure, delightful interactions for an aging population. I think those are all great themes. Another one that strikes me as useful is innovation around sort of active street life, by which I mean, you know, the idea of urban theater and urban engagement and enjoyable urban activities. But within that, there's 100 little sub-strategies: designing a city for great biking access, designing a city for great parks, you know, those kinds of things.
Larry Keeley heads Doblin, headquartered in Chicago. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is founder and president of America Speaks. Under her leadership, America Speaks has earned a national reputation as a leader in the field of deliberative democracy and democratic renewal. Prior to founding America Speaks, Carolyn served as consultant to the White House chief of staff. At the percentage of Americans who exercise our right to vote, do people really care about public decisions?
Carol, people really do care about public decisions, and people are angry and disgusted with the electoral system in this country. In our work at America Speaks, we've found that it's much, much more likely for citizens to come back to the table with elected officials on policy issues than it is to be able to encourage them to vote, particularly after the debacle in 2000. And frankly, in 2004, in certain states like Ohio in this country, the public trust in our electoral process has hit an all-time low.
But if they simply engage on policy issues, and that's a wonderful thing, but if you can get them to engage on policy, don't they still have to take that final step of engaging at the voting booth?
Absolutely. There's no question but what we have to have Americans engage in active voting, active expression of their citizenship responsibilities. But, Carol, too often we as liberal Democrats, small d, exhort people to come to the polls without really listening to what is now at least 30 years of very expressed data from Americans about their distrust of the electoral process. They're angry about special interests. They're angry about the money in politics. They, at this point, have actually decreased their trust in whether or not their vote is registered the way they vote it. Carol, very much from the spirit of how you're talking, after the 2000 election, I traveled to Florida because I thought 2000 would bring an upsurge of voting in our country of people who had not previously voted, because it was so crystal clear that one vote makes a difference. But in fact, in the African American communities where there was clear evidence of voter suppression and where it was made very difficult for people to get to the polls, that experience actually just reflected decades of their belief that no matter what they do to try to get to vote, something will be impeded to keep them from easily exercising their right to vote. So it's just an example of the reality that exists for literally millions of Americans in terms of how they experience how they are treated as citizens looks and feels very different than for those of us who have a lifetime of experience of taking steps to make a difference and being rewarded for taking those steps. So I totally agree with you. Citizens have to vote, but we have to look carefully and listen carefully to the reasons that they don't vote.
Carolyn, you talk about using deliberative tools at America Speaks. Explain what you mean by deliberative tools.
Well, if you think about the foundations of American democracy, our founding fathers had the deep, deep conviction that people were capable of self-governing. And the first expression of that was the New England town meeting, in fact, which still exists in many New England states today, where citizens on an annual basis came together, talked with one another, and then actually make a collective community decision about their community budget and their school budget. Today, in the 21st century, we can enhance that deliberative process. The fundamental tool is people sitting around a table, face to face, and talking about what they really believe is the direction for their community, the direction for our country. Given where the information technology explosion has gone, given the scale of our country to date, that core foundational tool of deliberation, people talking face-to-face with one another, can now be supported and enhanced and taken to scale. The particular model that we use in America Speaks, let me give you a very concrete example, Carol. Here in Washington, D.C., starting in 1999 with Mayor Anthony Williams, America Speaks has conducted every 2 years something we call the Citizen Summit. In the Citizen Summit, we bring together 3,000 demographically representative citizens of Washington, D.C. It can't be just the usual suspects. It can't just be whoever shows up at a town meeting. It has to be every geography. It has to be every age. It has to represent genders correctly, age, ethnicity, and income. We gather those people together. The mayor puts in front of them the draft strategic plan for the next period of the city's future. Attached to that plan are the specific programs in education, in community violence, in youth and outreach for young people, in families, in economic development, and frankly, how does government work? How do you make government function better? Each cycle of this work, the mayor then takes those key questions to 3,000 people. They are seated at 300 round tables, 10 persons to a table, with a highly trained process facilitator, someone who really knows how to make the process at the tables totally democratic. Because, Carol, you know as well as I do, if you didn't do that, personality style and shyness would dominate. So some people would be very talkative, some other people would not be. So the table facilitator ensures democracy at each table. Each table also has a wireless laptop computer. So as the table talks through its relative priorities between education, economic development, community policing, etc., they tap their response into that computer. That's hooked up to a central computer where people real-time are reading all the data coming from all 300 tables. They read that data for two things. They read the data for themes that are common to all 300 tables or to 200 tables, and they look for great outlier ideas that may have just come up at one table, but that possibly a lot of citizens would support if they knew about the idea. So this information is then flashed up on large audio-visual screens in the center of the room, so all 3,000 people can simultaneously see the outcomes of the small face-to-face discussions at each table. In every case, the themes will somewhere, you know, between 10 and 20 ideas that have risen to the top out of that process. Then every person in the room has a keypad polling device that they then can express of these 15 to 20 themes that came out of the full room's discussion of the collective views of Washingtonians together. These 15 to 20 ideas can now be rank ordered simply by asking every single person in the room to express their preference of which priority is the most important. And let me give you concrete results. In 1999, the first time we did this, citizens' focus was on education. They said that we got to do something about the public schools in Washington. At that time, like in most American cities, the mayor didn't even have control over the school board or the school system. But the citizens' voice was so strong and so clear that the mayor said, if, in fact, the superintendent and the school board will agree to a public accountability process, I will take $70 million out of my other agency programs and give it to the school system above their budget request. This began a first set of public accountability investments in the D.C. public schools. When we convened citizens again 2 years later, many people were skeptics and said, okay, it worked the first time, the public really landed on education. But, of course, in 2 years the schools aren't fixed, so why would we expect the citizens to tell us anything different? Well, Carol, I don't think this will surprise you because of the kind of work you do in cities. In fact, in that two-year period of time, the biggest change in Washington, D.C. was a huge reinvestment both in downtown and in neighborhoods in terms of real construction in the city. What was the largest issue on people's minds in D.C. in 2001? You've got it, gentrification. That year, what the public picked as its highest priority was helping the mayor create an affordable housing trust fund that would really be protected no matter what happened in the economy over the next 10 years. And because there was such a public outcry for this, and because the votes for this were as high in affluent Northwest as they were east of the river, where concentrations of lower-income people live in Washington, this trust fund was actually created, and $25 million more were put into it than the mayor ever dreamed he could have accomplished on his own. So by using this kind of methodology, you create public will. You create a public constituency that actually will stand with an elected official who's ready to do the right thing, but needs someone behind he or she if they're going to step out and lead.
And what happened to education in 2001?
Education stayed a high priority as well. And in fact, it was in 2001 that the mayor was able to put forth to the public a choice about bringing the school board partly under city mayor's control so that there was a balance between elected members and appointed members. So it didn't fall off the agenda, Carol. It stayed a solid part of the agenda as it has for 8 years. And it was important that citizens could express what a newer, more critical, immediate need was.
Do you find that there is then a direct link between people who participate in this kind of process, a public leader who can then step up to the will of the people, as you put it, and then to people participating in an election, in voting?
A great question. We have been tracking, as best we can, people who participate in the kind of deliberative forums that we've created all over the country and on local issues, regional issues, and national issues. What you see immediately, Carol, is an increase in citizens' participation in additional community activities. For example, in the D.C. case, the mayor, about 2 years later, began a grassroots approach to a comprehensive plan directed out of the city's planning department. Based on records in the city for decades, the number of citizens in neighborhoods that participated in the comprehensive planning process was increased by 25% to 30% in most neighborhoods. So there is evidence to demonstrate that they stay more active on their community and policy issues. We have not been able to identify resources to support us following through on your critical question is, are they more likely to vote? We have anecdotal evidence, which says absolutely that's true, but what we're in need of is the resources to actually do this as a longitudinal study in several cities in the United States. I'll tell you what I believe from listening to cities and listening to citizens and tracking this for a while. I think you will see an increase in voting behavior, but that it would be on a 5 to 6 year cycle when, in fact, they have seen that what they did on the policy planning resource allocation area actually happened. Citizens' trust in institutions in this country has been so broken that they want to see the evidence before they reinvest in the game.
Interesting. You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer. She is founder and president of America Speaks. Do you think, Carolyn, there's more willingness to engage on local issues versus important national or even state issues?
Actually, Carol, we see equal readiness to engage, whether the issue is community level, state level, regional, or national. Now, your question's really important because the belief that it will make a difference immediately is higher on the local level than when you go to the state and national level. But let me give you a current example. As part of the Medicare Prescription Drug Act in 2003, Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah and Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon got an amendment connected to that law called the Health Care for All Americans Act. And that law requires the creation of a Citizens Health Care Working Group, which operated in the year 2005, and then requires 6 months of community forums on healthcare reform in the United States. America Speaks and public forum institutes have conducted these deliberative forums in 41 states. The Citizens Healthcare Working Group will give its first draft recommendations on June 1st. Your listeners might want to go to the website, www.citizenshealthcare.gov. But my reason for giving this example, Carol, is directly in response to your question. We will have had over 20,000 Americans step up and share their views on healthcare reform in this country, and do so gladly and willingly.
Have they done it online or in person?
The opportunity has been both in person with the kind of meeting format that I described to you first, or they also can do it online. And by the end of the process, we will have had about equal numbers of people who have gathered face-to-face and people who have participated online. In fact, I'd highly encourage your listeners, that's why I gave the website, to go online. They can still express their opinions about what direction healthcare reform should go as you and I are talking.
A question for you. I can express an opinion, and it can be informed, it can be uninformed. It can be informed by fact, it can be informed by others' opinions. I'm just curious, how do you sort out this deliberative democracy thing? I mean, how can you move it closer to a deliberation with real facts and real insights versus, you know, this sort of convenient packaging and convenient slogans that political parties and advocates tend to put on things?
Carol, that is absolutely essential. Real deliberation is based on having enough information about the possible options and the pros and cons on each of those options so that, in fact, the citizens who are deliberating are making informed decisions. In each one of the processes that we sponsor across the country, every citizen receives a participant guide prior to participating, which has all the background and context information on the issue and has all of the options that represent the entire liberal to conservative spectrum in this country, and then allows them to look at a pro-con analysis of each of those options. Carol, I think you'd be interested to hear, the very first time we ever used our method was in 1998 and 99 on a Social Security discussion across the country. And Northwestern University did a blind study, a social science research where they matched participants, interviewed everyone 6 weeks before they participated in the deliberation, both the participants and the matched study, interviewed them the day of the participation and 6 months later. Northwestern said they had never seen results like this before. 6 months after the event was over, 82% of the people who participated could still report to the researchers specific facts they had learned about Social Security that had changed their minds on where they thought the policy options should go. So it's really clear that if you gather the information, you present it to citizens in an accessible way. And let me say, for example, here in D.C., when we do the budget work, because of the extraordinary reality about adult literacy in Washington, D.C., we have to ensure that the participant guide can be done mainly in images and numbers, because many adults in this city cannot actually read complex material. Another question that may jump to your mind is, in all of our urban cores in this country, we're now dealing in a society that is multilingual. So, for example, in Washington, D.C., when we do the budget summits, the materials are translated into 6 languages. When we did the health care work in the vast majority of the cities, we actually provided the material in 3 languages, always Spanish and English, and the 3rd language depending on what the concentration of another language was in that city. So your fundamental question is, well, I would assert deliberation to understand the collective wisdom of ordinary people has to rest on the knowledge that the people who participated in the deliberation are very well informed on the issue.
And you feel that can be done adequately online?
That's a larger challenge online. It definitely can be done face-to-face. It can be done online for a literate population. And then, Carol, we have to acknowledge that there is a significant digital divide in this country. We often think of the digital divide being only low-income communities and particularly minority communities. but it's equally important to recognize that there is a real digital divide, urban and rural, in this country. And that is a result of how the broadband capability is and is not available across the country.
We only have a few minutes left, Carolyn, but tell me, what are the issues that divide us today in America, where you believe America Speaks could bring us to a new understanding of our options, a third way?
Carol, you're probably aware of this, but one of the extraordinary truths about American society is we are a country of people who are extremely, we have deep, deep values, and we highly prize the ability to take action in a pragmatic way. So if you bring all of us together in a room, we very quickly move to the center. Radical options on the conservative end and radical options on the liberal end drop off the table. Our trust in the collective voice of people could and should move us forward on issues that today cannot come out of Congress because of the partisan process that dominates. First and foremost on the agenda today is immigration. I am very certain that if we pull together demographically representative groups of Americans all over the country, we would discover an area for policy development that would satisfy the vast majority of the American public. An additional area that today would be extremely useful for this kind of work would be in the whole arena of how the country responds to a travesty such as happened on the Gulf Coast, or more in people's minds today even, is the issues around a pandemic. Clearly, the country's ability to respond calls for seamless capacity between the federal government, state government, local government, and, Carol, what citizens themselves can do. A third area that is deeply in Americans' minds today is the whole issue of environmental degradation. And whether you want to think of it as global warming or climate change, ordinary folks are ready to sit at the table and look at the intersection between environmental policy and economic growth capacities of this nation in a global economy. They would be able to state a direction they would like to move that is above and beyond the fray that has been produced by partisan politics for two decades.
Well, it would be nice to see movement on any or all of those very important issues you outlined. Perhaps we can convince you to come back and tell us more. Thanks, Carolyn, for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is president of America Speaks. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to find links to more information on what you heard today, sign up for podcasts and our weekly newsletter, and find archive shows. Smart City's web content and audio archive is supported by CEOs for Cities, a cross-sector network of urban leaders working to speed innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. Our theme music was produced and performed by Steve Selvage and Robbie Grant, with additional music provided by Chris Reyes. Eric Rudd engineers Smart City. Daphne Scott is our production assistant. I'm Carol Coletta.